This is a reading of the cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is lecture 12, given in Dornach on April 1st, 1920. Reflecting on the connection, which we sometimes encounter in very strange ways, between external phenomena and internal human phenomena, is fundamental to the perception of professional healers. Such reflection yields very significant intuitions with regard to the nature of therapeutic substances. To mention one example, let me remind you of how some good spirit seems to have formulated substances such as Ronsenio water or Levico water, developing them in advance in outer non-human nature under specific circumstances, expressly in order to prepare a number of forces capable of playing a beneficial role in the human organism. Footnote, Ronsenio, I'm pronouncing that Ronsenio, and it's spelled R-O-N-C-E-G-N-O, and Levico, L-E-V-I-C-O, are mineral waters from the Dolomites, limestone mountains in northern Italy. End of footnote. During the next few days, we will characterize such matters thoroughly. If we think about how wonderfully the two forces of copper and of iron offset each other in this water, and about how arsenic is also present to provide a broader basis for this interaction, we realize that something is being prepared in the outer world with specific regard to certain conditions in the human being. It is absolutely possible for such things to have extremely unfavorable effects on some individuals, but even the negative instances demonstrate the general fruitfulness of the overall principle. It is especially important to point this out whenever such things are talked about today, because reflecting on them makes it possible to combat certain illnesses whose symptoms are only now appearing. Let us not forget that truly unbiased observers are beginning to realize from all sides that very specific circumstances are now spreading over parts of the globe and evoking very specific forms of human illness. We must also not forget another intriguing modern phenomenon, namely a very peculiar characteristic of even a condition like ordinary influenza in its modern manifestation. It wakens dormant illnesses, illnesses to which the organism is predisposed, but that otherwise remain hidden by the organism's counteractive forces. Under certain circumstances, these illnesses might even remain dormant until the death of the person in question. But they are uncovered in some way because the person comes down with the flu. All of this adds up to a cluster of questions that I will use as the basis of these lectures for the next few days. In order to get off to a productive start, I would like to mention another remarkable concordance whose entire profound significance can become apparent only to spiritual scientists. As you know, oxygen and nitrogen are loosely bound to each other in our atmosphere, in a way that cannot be properly explained physically or chemically, as it were. As human beings, as earthly human beings, we are totally enmeshed in the activity that emanates from oxygen and nitrogen. From the very beginning, therefore, we can suspect that the fundamental proportion of oxygen to nitrogen is important. The important thing that spiritual science shows us is that human sleep disturbances are linked to any change in air composition that tends to alter one way or another the usual proportion of oxygen to nitrogen. This phenomenon leads us to investigate the underlying relationship more exactly. As you know, spiritual science prompts us to say that the human being consists of four members, the physical, etheric, and astral bodies, and the capital I. You also know that the phenomena compel us to say that on the level of dynamics, at least, the I and astral body leave when a person goes to sleep, and they move back in when the person awakes. We must realize that in the sleeping state, the astral body remains bound to the I and the etheric body to the physical body. Therefore, during the waking state, we see that the astral body and I are related to the etheric and physical bodies more loosely than either the I and the astral body or the etheric body and the physical body. This looser internal relationship within the human being between the upper principles, I and astral body, and the lower, etheric and physical bodies, truly reflects the loose relationship between oxygen and nitrogen in external air. The correspondence is remarkable. Because of how the outer composition of air is fixed, it also provides a gauge for the relative connectedness of the astral body and the etheric body, or of the physical body and the eye. This correspondence also makes us aware of how we must relate to the air's composition. We must pay attention to whether we are in a position to supply people with air of the appropriate composition, or whether they must do without. At this point, however, you can delve still deeper into physiology and perceive this correspondence. If you go through all the known substances that fulfill some function in the human organism, you will discover that they are all bound up with other substances in the human organism, generally in the form of compounds and solutions. The only elements that exist in a free state within the human organism are oxygen and nitrogen. Therefore, the constituents of external air play a very specific role in the human organism itself. The interrelationship between oxygen and nitrogen is absolutely central to the material aspect of the human being. Oxygen and nitrogen play a specific part in human bodily functions as the only substances that work in their free state, not allowing their effects to be modified by being bound up with other substances in their sphere within the human organism. This shows you that what we can trace extending from external nature into the human organism is not the only important thing. We must also trace the how, whether the effects of the substance in question remain free or are linked to those of others. The strange thing is that substances develop specific affinities and relationships to each other within the human organism. If we introduce one substance when another one is already present in the human organism, such an affinity or relationship can appear. If you pursue this thought further, it leads to a very specific intuition that spiritual science needs to point out. You know that proteins form the basis of plant, animal, and human organisms, and that in the sense of modern chemistry, the chief constituents of protein are the four most important substances in nature: carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and hydrogen, with the addition of sulfur, which homeopathically pervades what the other four substances do. We need to come to an idea of how proteins actually function internally. The modern science of chemistry tends to assume that the configuration of such a substance is imposed by its intrinsic forces. The inevitable consequence of this assumption is that substances are described as identical when they are not, or at least not to the extent that we imagine. Whenever any difference at all is acknowledged, equating the two substances is not justified. Seeing plant protein and animal protein as similar, as chemically identical to a certain extent, is only a consequence of this atomistic way of thinking about the structure of protein, and is totally unjustified. If we observe the human organism more precisely, it becomes apparent that plant protein neutralizes animal protein, and especially human protein. These two proteins stand in a polar relationship to each other, in that the one cancels out the effects of the other on an intimate level. This is the strange phenomenon that we must acknowledge. The functions of animal protein are such that they are diminished or negated, either partly or wholly, by the functions of the plant protein. This leads us to ask what the difference is between a substance of this sort, as it occurs in the animal or human organism, and in the plant organism. You see, in the past few days I have spoken about the important role played by the organ systems, the kidney urinary, the liver, and the pulmonary systems, with regard to meteorology, to the supra-earthly factor. To these, I added the cardiac system. These four organ systems play a crucial role in the human being's relationship to meteorology, to what is outside. What do they actually signify from a more intimate perspective? These four organ systems are nothing less than the creators of the structure of human protein. They are what we need to study, not protein's molecular or atomic forces. When we wonder why protein is the way it is, we must understand it as being internally built up as a result of the emanations of these four organ systems. Protein is a consequence of their interactions. This also says something about the internalization of external effects in the human being. What modern chemistry seeks in the structure of substances themselves must be attributed to organ systems. The structure of human protein cannot be imagined to exist out in our earthly surroundings. When it is not under the influence of these four organ systems, this structure cannot persist and absolutely has to change. And again, let me read these again. There's a diagram here. The four organ systems he's talking about, one is the kidney urinary system, another is the liver system, another is the heart system, and the last one is the lung system. End of my aside. It is different with plant protein. Although plant protein at least appears uninfluenced by such organ systems, it is subject to other influences. It is under the influence of oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen, and carbon, and of whatever else is present in the external meteorology of nature as a whole, and also to the influence of the sulfur that mediates their functions. In plant protein, these four substances that are dispersed in the atmosphere give rise to what is brought about in the human being by the heart, the lungs, the liver, and so on. In outer non-human nature, these four substances contain the formative forces that are individualized and contained by the four organ systems within the human being. When we say the names oxygen, hydrogen, and so on, it is important to think of these so-called substances not only in terms of the intrinsic forces modern chemistry speaks of, but also in terms of formative effects that always have relationships to one another inasmuch as they contribute to the Earth's repertoire of substances. If we go into detail and associate these substances with the corresponding internal organs, we must equate what oxygen does in the outer world with the renal urinary system. We must equate the formative forces that carbon develops on the outside with the lung system. That is, with the lung's own formative forces rather than the pulmonary system as a system of respiration. We must equate nitrogen with the liver system and hydrogen with the cardiac system. External hydrogen is the heart of the external world, while nitrogen is the external world's liver, and so on. It would be desirable for modern humanity to take the initiative to work out these matters instead of merely being persuaded to acknowledge them. You see, if we consider the cardiac system's relationship to the formative forces of hydrogen, we will immediately recognize the importance of hydrogen activity as such for the entire upper region of the human being. Hydrogen's development in the direction of the upper part of the human being is accompanied by the transformation of the more animal aspect down below into something human, something that moves in the direction of concepts, and so on. In a previous lecture, I told you that we encounter an influence that is supra-earthly, and it was identified as lead. You recall how we described lead, tin, and iron as forces having to do with the upper part of the human being. As yet, there is no great tendency today to acknowledge such connections. There is no great tendency to move outward from the human being to see lead's effects as particularly related to the phenomenon that the human heart prepares hydrogen, which in turn becomes the vehicle for preparing our thinking apparatus. The unconscious progress of human evolution coerces human beings into acknowledging this fact, although I do not mean this in the sense of propagandizing. Now that science has confirmed that lead, along with helium, is a byproduct of the disintegration of radium, it can no longer be denied that lead plays a role of some sort in external non-human nature, even if we consider it only with regard to its functions. The lead that has been found in this context, although its so-called atomic weight is not quite right, is nonetheless considered lead. Tin and iron will also be found under similar circumstances. These are substances that are external to the human being, but are simultaneously uniquely involved in human nature. I think we should not simply allow ourselves to be coerced by such phenomena as radiology, which is actually a wonderful hint that if we go out into the non-human world, we may discover not crudely material metals, but the metal forces that are working in from above the earth. This is something that needs to be said today, because the appearance of new modern types of illnesses will make us realize that we absolutely must take such matters into account. At this point, we must be particularly interested in the fact that the interaction of external carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, which is mediated by sulfur, is taken over internally and individualized by the four human organ systems. If you reflect on a matter such as this correctly, you will perceive the depth with which it is possible to see into the human being when considered this way. It will no longer seem miraculous when involuntary human processes, ones that do not initially seem to be immediately subject to our mental functions, are viewed in relation to the whole of external non-human nature. Here again, it is true that each of these four human systems has the tendency to, quote-unquote, become the entire human being. Take the renal system as an example. I might say that the kidney, with its functions, attempts to become the entire human being, as do the heart, the liver system, and the pulmonary system. It is important to convince ourselves of the questions that come into consideration here by using our own eyes, or rather our own sensations, to discover how we can observe certain external effects within ourselves. It is almost impossible to avoid pointing out a clear-cut boundary between natural science and spiritual science in this regard. In reality, you see, as you make progress in your meditative life as medical practitioners, as you understand more and more how to achieve harmony with a meditative life, so that you feel yourself to be a meditator, you will increasingly acquire concrete self-knowledge of a sort that is truly not to be scorned when we are dealing with positive tasks in life, such as healing. As you make progress in meditation, you will notice that you become conscious of things in your own organism that were formerly totally unconscious. By simply taking into account what rises to consciousness, you become aware of something that is still difficult to speak about in lectures to the public or to lay audiences because of a very distinct inclination that emerges in that context. Given the present-day moral constitution of humanity, if we were to talk about such matters, and I am now drawing your attention to one of the elementary ones, and communicate them to wider circles, the following questions would immediately arise. Why don't we take advantage of that? Why should I meditate if I can achieve the same result more easily by simply swallowing some substance or other? It is more comfortable to take a remedy instead of meditating. In some respects, people who do this destroy themselves morally. Given the present-day moral constitution of humanity, people would be relentless. You will soon see what I mean. Instead of meditating, they would prefer to take an external agent that would help them take the first steps toward a result similar to that of meditation. It is really possible for this to happen. You see, if you continue meditating for a certain period of time and are inclined to take such phenomena into account, you will become aware of the radiating effects of iron in the same way that you are aware of having hands that allow you to pick things up and feet that allow you to walk. It really is true that being conscious of the effect of iron appears in the same way as the consciousness that you have arms and legs or a head that you can turn. What appears is the consciousness of feeling yourself as an iron phantom. I mean that people would come along and say that it is possible to heighten your sensitivity to the iron within you by external means, by means of something you ingest, in order to get the effect of meditation. With regard to certain steps, this is absolutely correct. But then the danger would be that people begin simply experimenting in this way in order to find an easy way to become clairvoyant. These things have often been done. It is different if they are done out of a spirit of sacrifice for humanity, but if they are done out of curiosity, they destroy the moral constitution of the human soul from the ground up. One man who performed a great many such experiments on himself was Van Helmont. This was how he discovered much of what you can now read in his writings. In the case of Paracelsus, you have the feeling that his insights arose in him atavistically from within, that he carried them into this world from a super-earthly world, while Van Helmont always acquired his strange insights by ingesting some substance or other. Footnote: Van Helmont and Paracelsus, see footnote, lecture 1, page 6, end of footnote. This is evident from how he presents his findings, and I believe he also says so quite clearly in certain places. Inner sensitivity to the radiant effects of iron is as close as we can come to the characteristic effect that bears witness to a radiating force that proceeds outward from the upper part of the human being, branching out into all the limbs. We gain a clear perception, and I use this word deliberately, that we are dealing with the iron inside us, or rather with its functions and forces. If I represent this iron radiation schematically, I must also mention, at the same time, that as such, it has no ability to work beyond the human organism. We always have the feeling that what is radiating outward is localized within the human organism and remains within it. Some counteracting force, something that arrests these iron radiating forces, is omnipresent. See Steiner's blackboard drawing on the following page. We might say that it is as if the iron radiates out toward the periphery, and something radiates back toward it in the form of spherical waves. These are the two effects we perceive, the radiating element and its collision with something impenetrable that does not permit it to go beyond the body's surface. We gradually notice that the opposing radiation is the force of protein. This means that iron introduces a functional connection that works against everything emanating from the four organ systems I mentioned earlier. These forces counteract each other. This battle, which is constant in the organism, is the first thing that can be sensed by means of inner perception. If we move on to study human spiritual history, we will clearly note that the medicine of Hippocrates and even that of Galen worked with remnants of inner observations of this sort. Galen himself was no longer able to perceive much, but he recorded all kinds of traditions that came down from earlier times. Anyone who can read Galen in the right way will probably find that a great deal of ancient atavistic medicine, which began to decline in the time of Hippocrates, is still illuminated in Galen's works, which is why they contain so many important views on natural healing processes. If we pursue such concerns, we will inevitably come to this polarity in the entire human organism between iron radiations and the influences that block them. It is important to look at these questions because everything that tends to form protein in the way I described always has to do with the blocking effects, while everything metallic that is introduced into the human organism has to do with the radiating effects. Admittedly, there are significant, extraordinarily characteristic exceptions to this rule, but here, too, these very exceptions allow us to look deeply into the strange interaction of the forces that assert themselves within the human organism, but come from all points of the universe. In order to do so, some things that I have already pointed out, the details of which you can then develop in your own thinking, need to be taken a bit further. For example, I need only mention that the carbon in plants, we can see this in Carbo Vegetabilis, which we looked at yesterday, lacks an element that animal carbon generally possesses, namely a certain nitrogen content. This accounts for the very different behavior of animal carbon and plant carbon when they are burned. It also accounts for the tendency of animal carbon to play a part in the production of such substances as bile or mucus or even fat itself. The differences we see here between animal and plant carbon lead us to look at how metals, as opposed to nonmetals, work in the human organism. I call this radiation and what arrests radiation. When we look at this polar interaction, we come to very important matters. You see, in the course of explaining spiritual science, I have often emphasized that human beings go through various periods in life, the period of childhood until the second dentition, the period from the second dentition until puberty, and the third period, which lasts until the early 20s. In reality, these periods of life are connected to processes intrinsic to the human organism. I have often characterized the first period, which concludes with the second dentition, as a process of self-limitation that focuses the entire human organism on separating out and incorporating its solid scaffolding. This process culminates in the emergence of new teeth from this human scaffolding. Obviously, bursting forth into solid form in this way must have to do with the overall development of the human form, especially its development toward the periphery. It is well worth noting that two substances that are otherwise not given their due in the human organism, namely fluorine and magnesium, are intimately involved in everything that is taking place here. Fluorine and magnesium are present in dilute form in the human organism and play prominent roles in the process in childhood that leads up to the second dentition. In terms of incorporating solidity into the human organism, what happens here is a constant interaction between the forces of magnesium and the forces of fluorine, with fluorine assuming the role of sculptor in the human being, rounding off and arresting the radiating element, while the magnesium forces ray outward, organizing fiber bundles and the like, so that calcium can infiltrate them. To say that a tooth comes about simply because fluorine, the sculptor, shapes it with regard to its size, cement, and enamel, while magnesium pours in the substance that is to be sculpted, is not nonsense, but is dramatically in line with what happens in nature. This is why it is so very important to maintain a balance between magnesium intake and fluorine intake in earliest childhood. You will always find that the teeth decay early if this balance is not properly established. We need to begin observing the child's dental development as soon as the first tooth appears to see whether the enamel is underdeveloped or whether the teeth tend to be small. Through appropriate diet, we must make sure to counteract any incipient problem by supplying the appropriate compounds of either fluorine or magnesium. We will have to speak about these things in more detail, but for now, I would like to approach the subject in concentric circles. This allows us to see into the process of human development, where we discover this interaction between magnesium and fluorine. It is characteristic of the substance fluorine to be markedly external to the human being during the first years of life, because in these early years, the human being really belongs to the outer world to a great extent. Fluorine is taken from the world, external to the human being, from the external principle that counteracts the radiant effect of metal. Similarly, if you take the third period of human life, it is very important to bring about the right balance between iron and protein, or protein formation. If the right balance is not achieved, and no strongly corrective developments emerge to offset the lack of balance between protein and iron, we confront all the outer symptoms of anemia. It is important that we not look at the developing human being only in a crude way, noting phenomena such as tooth decay, for which the groundwork was laid at an earlier age, or looking at anemia only from the modern chemical perspective. We must delve into the entire mystery of the human organism if we want to understand anything of what appears in an individual who is ill. You all know, more or less, which metals play a part in building up the human organism internally. With the exception of iron, the metals that I described to you as the most important in a certain connection, lead, tin, copper, mercury, silver, gold, and iron, are not involved. With the exception of iron, as I said, they have no direct effect on the overall functioning of the human organism. But this does not mean that they are any the less active in the human being. If we trace the substance that is most involved in developing what is located near the periphery of the human organism, we find that it is silicon. I have already spoken about this. But the processes going on in the human being are not simply contained within the skin. The human being is also enmeshed in universal processes. Just as the substances you know of are significant within the human organism, the metals I have just listed are significant outside the human organism, but work into it. Iron alone plays the role of mediator between what lies within a human being's skin and what lies outside it. We can say that the entire system that appears in the pulmonary human being, which, as you know, attempts to become a whole human being, is strongly connected to our entire relationship to the life of nature in the universe. We must realize that we take only one part of the human being into account if we consider anatomy alone. This is not the entire human being. It is simply that aspect that counteracts the external principle consisting of the effects of lead, tin, copper, and so on, effects that are external to the human individual. It is never permissible to restrict the human being to what is inside the skin, not even when we are simply considering the human organization in a natural scientific sense. As we can see, it is not simply a question of effects that make their way from within outward. We must also take into account the effects that provide some sort of direction for human organic processes. What follows will demonstrate that this is a very significant consideration. You know that certain substances take effect in the human organism simply because they are bound to alkalis or acids, or because they appear in a neutral form, as is said in science, as salts. But the relationship of bases to acids as polar opposite systems of forces that enter a neutral state of sorts in salts does not cover this subject in its entirety. We must also take into account the relationship of the acid-base-salt trinity to the overall direction of human organ forces. We will find that all alkalis tend to support processes that begin in the mouth and continue in digestion, working from front to back. Similarly, all other processes that run from front to back also have such a role. Bases have to do with the front to back direction, while acids have to do with the reverse. Only when we look at the contrast between the front and back of the human being do we arrive at the contrast between bases and acids. The salt-like principle relates to these two as if it were directed downward toward the earth, standing vertically on both. Salt throws itself into all processes that work from above to what lies below. For this reason, we must absolutely take these three directions into account in considering how the human being fits into the alkaline, acidic, and salty elements. These directional forces are another example of how observing the human being bridges the gap between the purely external chemistry of metals and human physiology. Here you also have the entire relationship of the salt-like element to the earth and the phenomena of bases and acids. Schematically, it could be drawn something like this. If this is the earth here, and there's a blackboard sketch on page 181, the salt-like element tends toward the earth, while bases and acids tend to move around the earth in circles. This in turn suggests that simply by becoming familiar with the directions of functions in the organism, we are then able to intervene in these directions. In this case, external remedies such as ointments and salves, everything that works externally, are crucial. At this point, we must also study the direction of external effects. Under certain circumstances, the extractive effect of a mustard plaster, or the effect of a metal ointment, suitably prepared, of course, can be just as important for the organism as any internal treatment. As will be clear to you from what I just said, we must simply know how we should use it, because it does make a difference whether we apply a plaster to one part of the body or another in a particular situation. It is essential to evoke the effect that counters a damaging force by applying the plaster to the right part of the body. Simply placing it on the painful or otherwise irritated spot is not always the right thing to do. The end of Lecture 12.